Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this special episode, finally catching up on Blade Runner 2049, which so many people asked us. When are you guys going to talk about Blade Runner 2049?
It was mostly just me asking.
It's October. Everyone, relax. Yeah, we'll get to it. It's not my
fault. Scary movie month. We wait all month in frenzied anticipation. Nothing will deter us from our goal.
Warner Brothers put the thing out in October. What do you want me to do? Anyway, so I am joined by JB.
Hello.
And the world's foremost Blade Runner expert, Jan
the
B.
The room's foremost Blade Runner expert. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you for inviting.
I'm excited to talk about this movie with you guys.
Me too. I'm so excited.
Are you? Because just in the last 3 days, I'm afraid she's a replicant.
It turns out that's not a problem.
Yeah.
I know it's real.
The movie's been out for over a month now. Still in theaters, but we will just go ahead and engage in spoilers right away. I don't think there's really any need to do the thing where we talk around certain things, because I think you almost can't talk about this movie
right
without spoiling anything. And I give the marketing credit for not revealing certain pretty significant things about the movie.
True. Speaking of which, you finally saw Thor, right?
Yes. Hey, have you guys seen anything good lately?
Is a big surprise in Thor, which is not a big surprise in Thor.
No.
Because it was featured in virtually every ad and trailer.
And all of the posters and every piece of press leading up to the movie.
And I don't want to give it away, but if you've seen Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, no, as soon as that deal was made, every website was publishing stories about, hey, the Hulk's going to be in Thor.
And it's a shame, because I think the film has strengths other than that one surprise.
Sure.
But clearly, it's been assembled so that that is a big surprise. In the reality of the narrative of the film,
yes,
they're clearly
right.
Building up to that.
Right.
And, of course, everyone on Earth knows. But I sat there in the theater and I thought, boy, if I didn't know.
That would be pretty fun.
Like Bill Murray's appearance in Zombieland.
Right. Almost the same thing. What did you guys think of Thor?
I thought it was terrifically fun.
Okay.
I did, too. I'm not as big of a comic book fan as you were. Or, of course, Mr. Pomero and Thass. But there was a time when I read comic books, and I think it's going to become the boring old cliche about Thor Ragnarok. But this is the Marvel movie that most seemed to me to be like a comic book.
Yeah, it was fun. It was entertaining. I thought it was funny. I've already forgotten
it.
And I feel bad about that.
But that's been the case of the last couple Marvel movies, where it's fine when you're watching it.
Yeah.
And then it fades
and
away.
And you know, people get very upset when we are at all dismissive of some of these movies, because people really, really love them, and that's great. But even Adam Riske's review last week, he was like, liked it, but a little bit indifferent, and people were sort of calling him out, like, why did you not like this more? Like, because he didn't like it that much. I thought everything until they got to Jeff Goldblum Planet was like kind of bad. It was so just like, and then we're in New York, and then we're in Norway, and then this guy shows up, and then we go here, and then we go here. And so when they get to Jeff Goldblum's planet, it's like, oh, okay, now there's sort of a story.
Nothing's gonna happen.
The Doctor Strange sequence seemed very shoehorned in, because now he's part of the universe,
right?
And Benedict Cumberbatch had 2 days open. I lost my train of thought. Yeah. Please continue. I'll remember.
I thought it was funny. I thought the performances were charming. You know, Chris Hemsworth is really good in the part. And I thought the Hulk was a lot of fun and hasn't been in other movies necessarily.
Well, they finally let him talk. What I was going to say before is I am such an amazing fan of Taika Waititi.
Yes.
And you know how I feel about What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
And I thought that other film,
Hunt for the Wilder People.
Hunt for the Wilder People was terrific. So it was really great to see him working in this Marvel cinematic universe that some other directors have found constricting. And I think keeping his voice.
Yeah.
Literally keeping his voice, because he voices that one.
Which is very funny.
Well, character. When you said, you know, that you didn't find it particularly memorable, I went right back to my memory banks, and the first memory of it that came up was his performance.
Yeah, he was funny, and I appreciate that this giant studio, like, hired him to make their big comic book movie, because he's not the obvious choice. So I like that they sometimes will take chances and hire really talented filmmakers and kind of let them be themselves.
But it also signals that they want Thor to go in a different direction, and this is going to be a segue to the next movie.
Okay.
Because we see a series of things happen in Thor Ragnarok that sort of resets the series.
Sure.
One of which is the tone change that we're talking about. And I think that's largely because Taika Waititi directed it, because if we remember, the first one was directed by Kenneth Branagh, sort of approaching the material much more in a Shakespearean way about Odin and his sons and things, and very sort of stately, and clearly they want to go in a different direction, so they're changing things up. Because Kenneth Branagh directed Murder on the Orient Express.
Yes, he did.
Which might be my favorite movie of the year so far.
I am fascinated. I haven't seen it.
You're fascinated not by the movie, but by that response from JB.
Yes, I'm so surprised.
And remember, this was a long time ago, you might not remember, when the first Pirates of the Caribbean came out.
Yes.
And it was so wonderful, because it was big and beautiful, and it had a story, and back then they knew who the leading characters were and who the supporting characters were.
Yes.
And it was like watching a movie from the 50s. And that's how I felt about Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay.
I might be alone, because the gentleman sitting to our left fell asleep during it, and some other people that we know recently came out and admitted that they fell asleep during it.
Yes.
But it is beautiful to look at.
It is gorgeous.
It tells this very engaging story, and I don't even think it's particularly slow, especially when you compare it to the funereal pace of Blade Runner 2049.
It is deliberate, but it's a movie that deals with such a huge cast that, in my opinion, there's really no other way to give, you know, for a character-run drama like a mystery, you need that time, I think so.
Is Johnny Depp the Jared Leto of that movie?
Yes.
But because of things we're not going to discuss about the movie, it's not nearly as much of a handicap.
Yeah, I could figure that out from the trailer.
Okay.
Yeah that's not a... I don't... Well, whatever.
He's the least Depp-like. Deppish.
Okay. Deppish. Is it showing in IMAX?
Mm-hmm. Not around here.
If it was,
but in some places it is?
According to Adam, New York and Los Angeles.
Okay.
And Adam told us a funny story. He was at another theater seeing another film, and there were these two women at the box office who, these strange creatures who don't decide what to see.
Right.
Until, which I've never been able to fathom.
No.
And they sort of wanted to see Murder on the Orient Express, but the ticket seller was sort of trying to talk them out of it. And the operant line here that Risky quoted, which is hilarious, was the ticket seller said, "You understand it's not a thriller."
Okay.
It is a very old-fashioned drawing room murder mystery.
Okay.
And it's done very, very well.
Okay. I recently watched possibly my first ever Agatha Christie adaptation, which was Evil Under the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from the cast, I was just kind of like, eh, whatever.
That's how I always felt about those movies. I never
like mysteries.
Yeah, but I never saw the original movie of Murder on the Orient Express, which is great because then this one was more fun for
me. That's when that original series, remember, the Sidney Lumet Murder on the Orient Express was a sensation. It was a big success. It got Oscar nominations, and it led to other films. I think that one was the third or fourth.
Okay.
And it was running out of gas.
Well, I think they're definitely setting that up with this.
There's some stuff at the end of Murder on the Orient Express that shouts, if this is successful, here's the one we're going to do next.
After the credits, we see where on the train the mystical glowing crystal has been hiding the whole time.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait till his mustache finds it.
The Christie Stones. The Christie Stones. They have to assemble the five Christie Stones. You have to make the joke on the podcast that you were going to.
Oh. Well, it's funny because you mentioned pirates. Depp's also in Pirates.
Right.
You talked about Depp. And I think Adam, in his column today, made an excellent point that 10 years ago, Johnny Depp would have played Equiperol.
Right.
And that is when I turned to John. I said, yes, but if he had done so, his mustache would be 4 foot wide and he'd be wearing a hat made out of kaleidoscopes.
What was that movie that he made like a year or two ago that where he was basically playing Poirot?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
do you know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It was the David Koepp movie. This is very upsetting.
The title is one word.
And it's like his name.
It's yes. a name.
Yeah.
It's like Mortimer, but it's not Mordecai.
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 Mordecai. Nice. Good job.
Nice. It took three of us to come up with Mordecai.
That's Depp's upcoming film. It's called Mortimer, and it's the biopic of Mortimer Snerd, Edgar Bergen's least memorable ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, he plays the dummy.
You should see the makeup.
Maybe my favorite Mordecai joke. Yes, I have one. Is I think it was on one of our year-end shows where Doug does the fake-out movie, and his transition was, my number seven is Mordecai, or I fucked it up. My number seven is Mordecai. Mordecai. It was better if I didn't screw it up first, but yeah. Mordecai.
I miss Doug's fake outs.
Oh, my gosh.
Me too.
I miss Doug.
What else have you guys seen?
What else have we seen?
Individually or together.
You've
you
seen
don't
more
just
stuff
come
than me.
As a unit.
Because I try and send him out of the house now. Go see movies on his own.
What did I see the other day? I went to Deer Park to see it.
It must be
must
equally
have been
memorable.
Really memorable. I saw a film that I keep getting the second syllable wrong.
Okay.
And it was the strangest thing. Wonderstruck.
Okay.
The new Todd Haynes film. And it was, you're looking quizzical.
Yeah.
Are you aware of this film?
I think so.
It actually got a fairly wide release. It's playing at several theaters.
And yet it is being overshadowed in the marketing by a film called Wonder.
Which I've seen plenty of trailers for.
Exactly. So
what's the Wonder film?
Wonder is Julia Roberts has the little boy with the facial disfigurement.
Okay, yeah. Now I remember that.
And he touches everyone's lives.
Yes.
Charlie leaned over to me during the trailer yesterday of Wonder, which he's seen several times, and he said, Owen Wilson plays Lightning McQueen. Said, yeah, he sure does.
Wonderstruck is the oddest thing. It's a real mixed bag. Todd Haynes makes some decisions that make it difficult to watch the film, although perhaps it just made it difficult for me to watch the film. The film has a soundtrack. People talk. It's closed captioned. When I bought the ticket, the ticket seller assured me that
it is not a thriller.
That this is not something wrong with the equipment, that we accidentally left the open captioning on, that's the way the filmmaker wants it. And as the film goes along, you pretty much figure out why he made that decision. But given that I have hearing, it's very difficult and distracting to watch. And it was the strangest film. I hated the first hour. Hated the first hour. Almost walked out.
Okay.
And then as if someone snapped their fingers, in the second half, it magically becomes this thing that's very engaging and very moving. I think the way they chose to tell the story, which is something of a mystery where you're trying to figure things out, might not have been the best way to tell that story. The movie owes a lot to a famous children's book called From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler about the two kids who hide out in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so odd. I found myself really liking the second half and actually being moved by the second half. But the first hour is really hard to get through.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I've been using my non-jury time to just mostly catch up on Stranger Things. So.
Yes. I haven't even started season two yet.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible person.
No.
But again, it started during October. Stop it, everyone.
Right?
Stop putting out stuff
get
in October.
Get on board.
Come on. I wanted to talk about Thor Ragnarok, which we covered.
It's going to come up again later, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
Exciting. Yeah. I finally saw The Beguiled, the Sofia Coppola remake.
What'd you think?
Did you guys see it?
No.
But it looked intriguing.
I wanted to love it.
Okay.
I think I only liked it. I'm a big fan of the Don Siegel original. And so I was very interested in A, seeing it told by from a female perspective, and B, seeing it told from Sofia Coppola's perspective. It's insanely beautiful and, like, perfect to look at. It kind of has one note until maybe the last 10 or 15 minutes. It eventually, I think, kind of gets to somewhere interesting, and in the final minutes I was like, oh, I think I see what you've been doing, but it's a little bit of a drag to get there. I was disappointed that it is, and again, you know, her movies tend to be very deliberately slow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that really works and sometimes it doesn't as much, and this one's kind of in the middle.
Yeah. When you say deliberately slow, do you mean like Blade Runner 2049?
I do not. Although that is also deliberately slow.
Much like Murder on the Orient Express.
Not a thriller. and then the other movie that I'll talk about, I have to be careful about where this conversation goes, but maybe it's a conversation worth having. So The Orchard, it's screener season, as you guys know, and so we're getting these envelopes each day. With some movies in them. Not much that I'm super excited about yet, but I believe on Friday we got a screener package from The Orchard, which is the company that was distributing Louis C.K.'s I Love You Daddy.
Yeah.
And had this story officially broke 2 days prior, I'm sure we would not have received that screener, but it was too late. It was in the mail. So it arrives at our house. And I don't even know how to talk about this movie. Like Erica had said, are you going to review it? I said, well, there's really no reason, because one, I wouldn't be reviewing the film. I would be reviewing the story around the film. And two, Orchard pulled it. People can't see it right now. What's the point in talking about, hey, here's this thing that you can't see? I think in addition to all of the grossness that sort of surrounds this whole story, which very much informs the movie, like it's weird to watch a movie where we have characters pretending to masturbate in front of a woman, or at one point Louis C.K. just openly says, I apologize to all women. I mean, these are moments in the film. But I think beyond all that stuff, I don't think it's a very good movie. Like, just as a movie, I don't think it's very good. It has some interesting things. John Malkovich is sort of interesting. Pamela Adlon is always great playing the same character she always plays, but she's terrific. Everyone in the movie is somebody. I mean, every part that shows up, Helen Hunt has two scenes, but it's Helen Hunt. Yeah. Hey, she's in the movie. But it is fascinating that, and I know these rumors have been circulating for years and now, you know, have all but have been confirmed even by Louis C.K. himself. Yeah. But I think the movie screened at a festival a month ago. I can't remember. That's where like people first heard about
it.
I remember. Hey, surprise, I made this movie. Here it is. And it got written about and it was like, oh, this is weird. Louis C.K. made a movie that's clearly about Woody Allen, because John Malkovich plays this.
Even the trailers that I saw really have that aesthetic.
Well, I can't figure out why else he chose to shoot it in black and white.
Yeah.
Unless it's a pretentious choice. It's, I think, to really underscore the fact that, hey, this is about Woody Allen. But here we are now, and you're not watching this movie about Woody Allen. Now you're very much watching this movie about Louis C.K. And it's a weird, gross feeling.
Yeah. You know how sometimes you go to a movie and while you're watching it on the screen, you'll think to yourself, this is just like that big political discussion I had with so-and-so the other day. This movie is completely mirroring what's going on right now in the national psyche. how did that happen since they were filming it 2 years ago?
Right.
You know, and
right.
since it was written right. even before that. And I think in a weird way, like, I don't know how that happens in art, but I think that somehow happened, like, in his life. Do you know what I mean? Like, he must have had this emotional residue. He can't see the future and say,
right.
this is when things
right.
are going to break.
Right.
This is when there's going to be a point of no return for
right.
me. And it's going to be, you know, November 2017. I got to make this movie now to get it out right then. But that seems to be what happened.
And
right?
that's,
I mean,
and that's one of the tragedies of Louis C.K., because as better minds than mine have expressed, he seemed to be a guy. His persona on stage was a guy who got it.
But
right.
I've also read some people criticizing that has all been, that this whole attitude, this whole aspect of his persona, even the fact, you know, you brought up Pamela Adlon. We've been watching Better Things. It's terrific.
It's the best show on TV
it's,
right
wow.
now.
It's terrific. It's 90% women. I mean,
it makes every other sitcom look like the boring, repetitive charade that
right,
they are.
Right.
And it does borrow a lot from the style of Louis,
mm-hmm.
but it completely moves it into the lives of these women and lets these female characters take center stage and own their own stories in a really positive, strong way. So when you look at that, and then I read a criticism where this whole persona of Louis C.K. has been sort of a, like a walking, not an apology, because he made a statement, but not really an
right.
apology.
Right, yeah, right, right, right.
But has been almost a, I don't want to use the word justification either, but has been his way of saying, it's okay. That was the old me. Here's the new me.
Okay.
So I don't need to address the old me.
Okay.
Because I heard someone suggest,
I'm not sure if I 100% yeah, right, agree with
right.
that, but
I heard someone suggest something a little different, that it wasn't the old Louis and the new Louis, that it was this persona that he adopts so that people let their guard down.
Hmm.
Now, that's pretty nefarious. That's,
yeah, but I was going to say that is a lot more insidious.
Dana Stevens reviewed the film for Newsweek,
okay.
acknowledging all the,
yeah.
the buzz.
How can you not?
And couched the review as, she was a really big Louis C.K. fan, and that's the lens through which the entire review. It really isn't a review. It's more of an essay
right,
about
right.
How she feels about what happened.
And it's bizarre because, yeah, he did have a very specific voice, and you felt like he was talking about things in an honest way, including owning up to weird flaws that he had
yeah.
in a very honest, almost confessional way. And I think that's true of this movie. I just think there was a limit to how much he would be honest or how much he would confess. And so it, now that we know all this stuff, it sort of throws everything else into relief mm-hmm. and makes it seem like it was all bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
Which makes everybody feel sort of duped almost, you know? I mean,
right. And
I don't know.
Angry and yeah. again not at him, like, you lied to us, because obviously he did far worse things,
and
but
I've already
read
things on social media that suggests that he will get past this because of the specific nature of what he did. But every time I see that, I think, and this might be cynical, tell that to Paul Rubens.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
but Paul, I mean,
he sort of has gotten past it as well.
Paul Rubens did kind of get past it.
And what Paul Rubens did is far less offensive.
Right.
Yeah,
he went to a house of masturbation and masturbated.
Yeah.
I don't know. Can you ever, if Louis C.K. hosted Saturday Night Live next week, or did a guest appearance on a sitcom, or Louis came back on, would you ever look at him and not think, like, you tried to make women watch you masturbate?
And yet,
I can't imagine watching that show again.
Right.
And yet,
at least in the foreseeable future.
Right.
Because you were like, now in this scene, is this right before or right after you did that other thing?
Right.
And yet, how much money is Daddy's Home 2 going to make with Mel Gibson?
Oh, this is, and I've been bringing this up too, that like Mel Gibson is in this huge wide release and was nominated for Best Director at the Oscars last year. Now, I recognize we're talking about two different issues, right?
Right.
Sexual assault versus, I guess, being a racist, anti-Semitic,
general
abusive piece of shit, because he was
assaulted his partner. So there's,
right,
you know,
the rumor is that he has a far larger part in this Christmas extravaganza than the advertising lets on.
I just don't, I don't know how we're supposed to be like, haha, he's funny, get it, forget he's a piece of shit.
Plus, based on the trailer, it seems to be a cynical attempt,
right,
that the character he's playing,
right, he's a bad boy,
right,
so haha,
which is really,
that's part of it, everyone.
I'm trying to think of the adjective. It makes me uncomfortable.
All of this, I mean, is really throwing so much. Last week, I went to see John Carpenter play with Heather, and he played the theme from Vampires for the first time on this tour. And both of us turned to each other, and we were like, it's cool that he's playing vampires, but now we got to look at James Woods, because they're always projecting, mm-hmm, you know, scenes from the movie. And it's like, I don't want to look at James Woods anymore. I don't want to see these people who have done these things. You just, this week we'll have a piece about Baby Driver and Kevin Spacey, you know.
And it's weird, because I was reading the piece today. I get to read all of JB's
pieces.
You're
so lucky. I generally don't.
And Jan,
I close my eyes and press publish and just
Jan
hope
had
for
a
the
suggestion,
best.
Because you have to say something, but how do you say something about it? That Jan had a suggestion about how I go about
but
that.
But the thing is, like, so now we find out what we found out about Kevin Spacey, and does that change the context of a movie like Baby Driver, where he's being really, really manipulative of a
right.
young boy who
yes.
he calls baby.
Yes.
Like, and you yes. you don't really, you that wouldn't come into your head thinking, see, it didn't occur to me when I saw Baby Driver the first time.
Right, right.
And now, how can it not?
You just thought, like, he's kind of a bad character. And now you're like, right. oh, he's a bad person playing a bad character.
Yeah.
I want this out of my head.
I think, you know, with the Weinstein stuff, with, and I think there's going to be more before there's less.
Yeah.
And I think we're all going to need to come to terms with being really uncomfortable because this is a transitional time.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to the time 10 years from now where we won't be finding out about things our heroes did 10 years ago because this happened at the time
right.
where those people
right.
would be doing them.
Right.
And it made them afraid to do them.
Right.
But until that comes, I think there's going
to
be a
really
difficult...
Wouldn't it be nice, too, if they just didn't want to do them? If they weren't just afraid
yeah.
to do them, but actually didn't have those impulses?
And hopefully that this whole process... But we also... And I might catch a lot of flack for saying this.
Oh, boy.
We have to have... at least the concept of redemption somehow for some people, for some, there has to be a way to move forward as well. You can't just look at people who've done horrible things mm-hmm. and then every time say, done.
Right.
Sometimes it's completely appropriate.
Right.
But you know that bar is going to go down. And
right.
it should.
Right.
We should be gradually lowering the bar
right.
on what never gets talked about.
Yeah.
But, you know, there has to be a process in place for moving forward, too. So.
Is this, obviously we need to talk about Blade Runner 2049 because this podcast
oh
will end
God,
up being
we just saw that last
as
night.
Long
it's,
as
yes.
Blade Runner 2049. But I keep wondering, you know, is this a, none of us work in Hollywood, right? That's
no.
safe to say?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that you guys weren't doing some shit on the side that I wasn't aware of,
Absolutely.
Punching up scripts and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy's Home 2. This is like a chicken egg scenario. Are predators and garbage people drawn to the entertainment business, or does having some amount of success in the entertainment business turn these people into predators and garbage people?
I think it's the latter.
Okay.
I think it's probably a little of both.
How can there be so many?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
We could argue that, like a politician, there's a certain mindset you have to have,
right,
to want that, to pursue that, to put up with what it takes to get elected, but also the incredible perks that come once you're elected. And the process of acting, of saying, I want to make my living doing this, I think, and I don't mean this in a pejorative word, in a pejorative way, it's not normal. It's not something most people would seek out,
okay,
to make a living doing that. So in that regard, I think you're right in terms of it being part of both. But once you're successful, successful on the order of success in Hollywood, mm-hmm, which is much bigger than being the best accountant in,
sure,
Des Moines.
Sure.
I think there comes with it, I think it's fraught with landmines.
I have to say that I'm not sure there are more in Hollywood than there are elsewhere. As a woman who's worked not in Hollywood,
right,
I've met plenty of creeps.
Okay.
And the ones in power, their power is not anything like Harvey Weinstein's in cultural currency.
Right.
In, you know, actual currency, you know?
within their little realm.
In the sphere of the other famous people they work with. You know, Weinstein had all this power. But you know what? If you're the president of a small manufacturing company and you're still making four times as much as your secretary,
mm-hmm,
there's still an imbalance of power. And I've seen so much shit like this.
Yeah.
So you don't hear about it.
Right.
And
right,
seemingly every woman on the planet has.
Yeah.
Because we remember.
Can we back that up and take out the word seemingly?
That the Me Too campaign.
Right.
Was amazing to me.
Which is amazing to me because I've been married to this man for 30 years. And he's not a sexist. He's always,
he's
college,
just a racist.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Well,
everyone,
some people need to know
Look,
their place.
He hates the Dutch. But look, so I...
Those fucking apple pies.
We've always had...
They think they're so goddamn superior with those apple pies. Okay, you put the crumbs on the top. Okay, we get it.
And we used to laugh, like when we were first married, we'd laugh about like, are you okay? He would get, people would say like, are you okay with her working? Like, fuck you, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah. Yes, but the fact that my husband was amazed by the Me Too campaign, after being that guy that I've known for 30 years, amazes me.
A lot of this
like
stuff...
You guys know this, don't
a
you?
A lot of this stuff that's happening lately just proves that I can walk through life with blinders on. I'm not going to tell the story again, but a couple years ago, I had a transgender student who completely upended everything I believed about that and sort of revealed that I had some Cro-Magnon attitudes that I needed to get over.
Sure.
But you did.
Yeah.
All it took was amazing, someone challenging it, in the slightest way.
And it
way
felt so good.
To yeah, actually have an experience with a person and not just as a theoretical thing.
Because yes, I like to think most people,
that's the key, Patrick,
yes,
will know when they're on the right side and that feels good. Oh, I don't have to walk around with that anymore.
No.
And I contributed to someone's happiness.
People are destroying Keurigs right now as we speak. They're destroying Keurigs.
As opposed to destroying child molesters.
Right.
I would go after the child molesters.
You would think.
The Keurig coffee, all good.
Not
it's
bad.
Very,
not,
it's very
a lot nice of different flavors. Super easy. Don't have to waste a whole pot. Kind of nice. Never tries to fuck a kid, which is kind of nice, too, as well.
Well, now you put that in my head.
I think part of the problem, not problem, I wouldn't say that I was, like, blind to it the way you're describing, right, because as I hear all the stories coming out and the Me Too, I mean, I'm amazed as more and more names are named. It's like part of me is like, Jesus, really? Everyone? But also not surprised, right?
Right.
But I think, and this is not to let you off the hook, J-Bones, not that you need being let off the hook, but like if you're anything like me, you have created a little bit of a bubble for yourself where I don't associate with people
right,
who act that
right,
way.
Right, right.
And if I'm standing around a group of men and they decide to turn the conversation to, like, aren't wives the worst, or making comments about a woman who's not there,
right.
I disappear from that group of men, you know? And really what I need to be doing is saying, hey, guys, shut the fuck up. But of course, I'm going to get beat up 100 times right. in my life. Just removing myself probably isn't helping. But because I have avoided these kinds of people, as far as I know, I'm less aware of how prevalent it is in my own day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But again, and that's the privilege of being a man, right?
Right. What's also sad to me is if there's 6 guys, including you, and they talk about, like, wives are the worst and they never cook us dinner on time, you're going to walk away from that shit.
Yeah.
And still feel like you should be doing more. There's probably 2 guys in that group who are going to stay. One's going to remain silent, but mm-hmm. he's going to stay. There's another guy who's going to say, yeah, they are the worst, and feel shitty about it.
Yeah.
So hopefully that will also change. Well, people don't have to stand and listen to stuff they feel shitty about standing
right.
and listening
right.
to.
One of the things, this is a compliment, sir, that I used to be annoyed by, but now I find very charming and endearing.
I don't like where this is going.
Is what you just talked about. A couple years ago,
uh-oh.
We were all over, and I was really complaining about something.
Probably me.
No, it wasn't. And suddenly, where's Patrick? You had walked away. I now think more people need to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
It was, where's Patrick? Yes.
All right. Well, I'm glad you turned around on that then.
I did turn around on that. And I'm also remembering, this was years ago, some female students were talking and allowing me to listen in about the male staff members who had very specific, very uncomfortable gazes.
Yep.
And I was listening to them and I was praying.
With the gaze of your ear?
Please not me. Please not me.
Yeah.
Please not me.
Yeah.
Please not me. And at one point they said, oh, you don't do that.
Oh,
and I'm
okay.
like, oh, thank God. Thank God. I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that.
Right.
And it was very disturbing when they said the staff members who routinely do that.
Of course. And again, you would think that the number of stories that come out about that right. would discourage that type of behavior. And maybe it has. I don't know. I mean, this is a separate issue and a separate power dynamic, but the same thing.
Yep.
I mean, the answer is to run for Senate.
I'm not perfect, but I'm not that. I'm not that.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think it's good to that as a society we're going through this process
mm-hmm.
of finally saying we're done.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Where did Patrick? Wait. He's gone. Where did he go? Look at him scoot.
I'm afraid that's what's going to happen when we finally start talking about Blade Runner 2049.
Well, and if you listen to this conversation and you're mad because
you mad. You mad because
you
thought
like,
we were going to
talk
about
why are you
Blade
guys
Runner.
Being political? We're not.
No.
This is not a partisan issue, and if what we're saying bothers you, understand that you're on the wrong side.
We're talking about artists in the motion picture industry, which is the
true
the subject of
correct.
This podcast, and also we're talking about decency,
right?
Which arguably should inform every podcast.
Exactly. All right, let's talk Blade Runner 2049 again. If you haven't seen it yet. Spoilers for Blade Runner 2049, because I'll just lead with one. I appreciated the fact that, A, the trailers didn't indicate that K was a replicant.
Yeah.
And that, B, they revealed that very early in the film. They weren't trying
yes.
to pull
no.
something over on you. It was just, hey, guess what? He's a replicant. Okay, now let's tell this story. And I thought, okay, yes, if you are going to do a sequel to Blade Runner, which we can all agree... maybe you didn't have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. We don't need this.
But?
At least we're getting it from a different perspective.
And if we're going to have a Blade Runner sequel, there's a lot to like in this film.
Absolutely. Yes. I think what you said to me, because you guys saw it first, And I was at your house dropping something off, picking something up. And I think you said, it doesn't shit on the original. And right. I thought, okay, good.
That's what it has to do.
It does a lot of good stuff on top of that. I'm still not convinced it needs to exist. It's very beautiful. It's incredibly well made.
Yes.
It doesn't ruin the original.
To the point you just made, which I completely agree with, the movie did that in a few ways, I think, that I was really... It's like they sat down and said, what are some of the minimum things we need to do in order to not shit on the original? Like, mm-hmm. And I think another great choice was this idea of the blackout. It's like they're saying, we aren't going to be able to walk you all back into that milieu.
Right.
Right. So how can we organically create a new milieu?
Mm-hmm.
I think I said that word wrong.
I'm pretty sure it was right. Poirot.
Hercule Poirot.
I am Hercule Poirot. Do you like my mustache?
Where is my left stocking?
So it's in the piano.
Are you guys ruining a Blade Runner joke? Oh. No one will have deeper cuts than Jan on Blade Runner.
So I thought that was a great way to sort of reset that, to sort of pay homage to what Ridley Scott was able to accomplish and what those, you know, Sid Mead and those folks, right?
Yeah.
Were able to accomplish without kind of pinning a mustache on it, you know?
Right. Like a Hercule Poirot mustache.
Yeah, a giant.
It does some interesting things in that it presents, you know, it's a little bit further into the future. It doesn't go out of its way to be like, we don't have flying cars anymore. Now we teleport. But it does introduce a couple of new visual ideas. I mean, the thing in Vegas is...
One of the things I liked a lot was, and it reminded me of what we were saying about Brawl and Cell Block 11.
99, but okay.
I'm sorry.
11 would have been very easy to get to.
Confusing.
He wouldn't have to go through all those other levels.
There's that Don Siegel film where it's Cell Block 11.
Right.
Riot in Cell Block 11.
Right.
That's my confusion. That the second prison exists to make the first prison look pretty good.
Yeah, right.
I wish you'd stay there.
So you're saying the future of Blade Runner 2049 is the red leaf.
Yes, the original Blade Runner presents a future that's awful, and then 2049 tops it.
Yeah.
Because if you thought the weather was doing strange things in the original, this is more overcrowded, and is that snow or ash? And boy, have we broken the planet?
Yeah. So I was really happy for decisions like that because I was happy when Denis Villeneuve was brought on board.
You're really brushing up on your French on this podcast. It's kind of nice.
Mais ouais. Because I, if you're going to try and ruin my childhood by, you know, remaking a movie.
Right.
At least there was this intentionality, I think, that really comes across. And I appreciated it.
And I guess I appreciate, you know, because one of the things that I was dreading seeing all the trailers was, but why does Deckard have to be in it? Just tell a Blade Runner story that's set in 2049, and here's what the replicants are doing, and here's what the world is. But, like, why does Harrison Ford have to keep coming back to all of his great things and doing them one last time? But to the movie's credit, I thought it tried to find a way to make him integral to the story in a way that wasn't just like, and hey, look who's here.
And I think it works if 2049 is a solitary narrative. But my problem is being so steeped in the original.
Mm-hmm.
The original wants us to ask whether Deckard is a replicant or not.
Yes.
And unless I'm wrong, and please correct me.
You know I will.
The fact that
this
Deckard...
is my single greatest joy in life.
Wives are the worst, right, JB?
It's a living hell.
Hey, where did I go?
That if that question of whether Deckard is a replicant is sort of tossed aside because, major spoiler alert, if he's a replicant and he was able to have a child with another replicant, that's, of course, the miracle that Dave Bautista is talking about at the beginning.
Either way, it's a miracle.
Right. But if he's a replicant, I don't think he would have aged that way. So 2049 is saying he's not.
Yeah.
I think...
Or is it just wear and tear on the old... I mean, I'm serious.
I think any... Now I'm going to push my nose, my glass up my nose. My glasses up my nose. You'll fix that later.
Yeah, no problem.
In the classic geek move.
I'm going to have Christopher Plummer say it.
What was I going to say? Oh, I think...
The question of Deckard aging.
Yes. Any... I'm actually believing this. Any replicant that would be capable of procreation would have to be an organic material enough to age.
That's okay.
The way a car ages.
It was something that I was dreading about the movie, because the first thing I said was, "Oh, the first thing they're going to do is answer the question: is Deckard a replicant?" And I thought they pretty much, there's one line of dialogue that's like, "Or maybe you're not." And
yes.
And then they move past it, and they're never super concrete about whether or not he is, which I appreciate, because, of course, Ridley Scott keeps going out of his way with every iteration of Blade Runner to say, he is, I promise, he is.
Yes.
Which I'm not interested in.
But there remains enough in the original movie Blade Runner, even in the final cut version,
mm-hmm.
that it's still a valid question mm-hmm. to say maybe he's not.
Mm-hmm.
And Harrison Ford still believes he's not.
Mm-hmm.
And I...
Unless he's being paid to offer a counterpoint to Scott.
I prefer a case in either film mm-hmm. where it is a question.
Right.
I much prefer
correct.
The ambiguity than just... In a previous podcast, you once made fun of this in a very funny fashion.
What? That you prefer the ambiguity?
No, that you were making fun of... people who don't want the ambiguity. This is a long time ago.
Okay.
You started doing Harrison Ford's voice
Oh.
and you kept reiterating over and over, but I'm not a replicant. There's no way I'm a replicant.
I think it was after we watched it for F This Movie Fest, which was the first F This Movie
yes.
Fest.
That,
because it was
I'm
the
thinking.
First time I had seen it with the voiceover in so long that I was like, oh, it's so clear how much he hates doing this yeah. voiceover. He's miserable. He didn't seem miserable in this movie.
Any more
no.
than Harrison Ford is usually miserable.
Yeah, again, I think it's weird, and I'm not the first person to bring this up, that everyone is very specifically costumed, and Harrison Ford is like, fuck it, I'll do if I can wear my pajamas. It's very strange that
yeah.
they're just like, we're going just t-shirt and sweats for you, Deckard.
Well, he's lived alone in Vegas for so long. No, he's...
There was actually a scene where he's in the Vegas penthouse where he lives now, and I noticed he's wearing shoes. And I'm like, man, if I lived by myself for 30 years, I would not own a pair of shoes.
Yeah,
I would
probably
never
not.
Own
the
shoes.
First thing you'd abandon.
If you're not going outside, really, except yeah. to take care of the bees, I guess, you need yeah. bee shoes.
You need bee shoes. You need bee shoes. But I think that's also something that the movie addresses pretty head on. I mean, there's a kind of there's a line that more than one character says through the movie, which is, I know what's real. And yet they use that word real to also refer, for instance, to the replicant prostitutes. She's
mm-hmm.
real.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you want something real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, so I think they're kind of really doubling down on that ambiguity. And I was glad, because that's where all the interesting stuff happens.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated that the movie is structured like a mystery. You know, whether or not it works as a great mystery, because I think even when it answers the question like, well, Ryan Gosling, you are the son, you are the special one. And that's interesting for his character, this idea that he wants so badly to believe that he's more than this and that he's something
right.
special. That stuff's super interesting, but even as that was happening, I, you know, my movie brain was like, oh, if you've already answered this question, it means you're not. You know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
But I have to say that the first time I saw it, I
oh,
got...
Oh, that's right, you've seen it twice.
No, I don't... I was snookered by that. I thought that's where the film was going.
Okay.
And then I applauded the fact that that's not where the film was going, and I thought that was good. And the second time I saw it, because I saw it twice, with that baggage out of the way,
yeah,
I more appreciated how that whole plot thread was done.
Okay.
I liked the movie a lot better the second time I saw it.
Okay.
But the pace is a problem.
There was a moment, and I was really liking the movie, and it's incredibly beautiful, and we saw it in IMAX, and it was so insanely loud, and it was like in actual, I mean, it's not technical IMAX, but it filled the whole screen instead of doing that thing where you get the black bars.
And it's a big screen.
It's gigantic, and it was just amazing to look at. But there was a moment, I think, when he first gets, when Kay first gets to Vegas, I think, where he's literally just walking around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the thought I had was, I can't imagine watching this scene again. Because I like the movie, and when I like a movie, you know, I'll watch it again. But it was taking such a long time, and I don't know that it was for a very specific purpose. I think it works in the moment. I think the first time I'm sitting through it, it's okay, because I'm willing to be patient, because I suspect this is going to pay off.
And because the visual of that shot or series of shots that you're talking about is impressive. But
I think the length of the shot is just another aspect of scale. So if you're seeing it in IMAX, it makes sense.
But once I know what the payoff is, I don't have the patience for that as much. Right, exactly.
It's
fucking bees? I got bees outside. What do I care?
Last night, after we saw it for a second time, I think Jan and I put our finger on the biggest culprit of the pace.
Okay.
Please correct me if I'm misstating this.
Yeah. No, we talked about this.
Jared Leto.
Yes.
Is not good. The part
I disagree with
the
that.
The part he is saddled with, the way he goes about with his performance, is one of the reasons why this film is so slow.
Okay.
I don't agree that he's not good, but I do agree that his characterization of Wallace is part of the pace problem. And just, you know, I just look back to, and I know I'm really hung up on the original movie, but
rightfully
when you
so.
Look at Joe Turkle's performance as the you know, narcissistic billionaire industrialist, and you compare that to Jared Leto's performance as sort of a crazy carnival version of the same thing. But he's just like, he's crazy and stuff. Like, I don't know how Jared Leto could get anything done. You could see how, no, I'm serious. So you see Joe Turkle as Tyrell, you know, we see him sitting up in his Pope bed in his silken robes. And we see him on the phone doing stock deals.
Right. Like conducting business.
Yes. But Jared Leto, the angels, which are the better part of our nature. Mr. Wallace, we're discussing the third quarter profit report.
He has an enormous room that exists just for that little birthing chamber right in the middle. It's like, this is a gigantic waste of space. You could put 10 of those in here.
I can't see that.
Right, but it's just, it's a striking image, but it's one of those things.
They lied to him about the specifications. No, it's exactly what you asked for.
And then, wait, you guys, like, we're going to put a moat.
It seems like just the choice of an eccentric.
Yes.
Which I know he's got the neck thing that sometimes allows him to do something. But how does he avoid stepping in the moat? Or is that another thing his employees have done? What I came up with, and I hate when people do this, I'm going to make the movie better.
Okay, right.
That not only would it partially address the pace problem, what if Leto's performance was pitched in a different way and he wasn't visionary lunatic? What if he said the exact same lines in a fast, clipped, businessman-like way? And then it would seem even more lunatic that this is the way this guy does business, but it's pie in the sky falderall in this very clipped business-like way, which actually tricks you into thinking that he's accomplishing something.
And would shave 15 minutes off.
Easily 15 minutes.
You know, I don't... He was another one of these things that I was like, oh boy, don't put Jared Leto in the Blade Runner sequel. No. And he wasn't distractingly bad for me beyond...
Go see it again.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, beyond his very obvious, like, I'm making an actor's choice, which has become the defining thing of his terrible career, is like, I'm going to play the Joker like this, and I'm going to play Wallace like this. And unfortunately, the character is just Tyrell 2.0, which is
part
of the problem.
And making the character blind. is a freshman film school metaphor.
Right. I think by playing him the way that you are talking about, I think it would make the aspect of his character, which is, I'm going to do Tyrell but better, more interesting, because then it becomes about certain accomplishments and certain ambition in a way that's more like a weird, like, Wall Street douchebag instead of the dreamer.
I can't believe that he's in charge of any business.
Right.
Because, oddly enough, that's exactly why he's been successful, is because he manages somehow to take this, you know, the way that the movie explains it is that, you know, replicants were hard to control. The Tyrell Corporation's motto, more human than human. Wallace was the genius who could see people actually don't want them to be more human. Why are we wasting our money on making them more human? We want them just a little less human so we could treat them worse.
Right.
And that's, so by commoditizing them even further, that's his business model. And that is in direct opposition to his personality for me. So I don't think his performance was bad. It was the least favorite thing of my of the movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because his performance itself was bad, but like you just said, I think his choices were not working for me.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's interesting that the movie introduces that idea, which, you know, in the original, we have Rucker Hauer, you know, talking about being a slave, essentially, because they are. And in this movie, they're openly saying, like, yeah, replicants are slaves. And yet, we don't really get any character who has that perspective. Now, is that just because they realized, well, the first movie kind of dealt with that?
Well, there's the resistance at the end.
They do talk about
where
we don't want to be slaves.
It's the replicants that are led by the one-eyed.
Right.
But
that to me is a little bit like lip service to that idea.
Yeah.
Unlike, I think, with Roy Batty, where it's the defining characteristic of
and
his person.
Leon.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What it's like to be a slave.
Right.
To live in fear.
When we saw it again last night, because we saw it twice, the thing I was really taken with
popcorn.
Is
oh, man, that sounds good.
It was
the
great.
Scenes where the K character has to get back to baseline, where there's that weird ritual where those phrases are exchanged, and his response doesn't seem to be a normal response, but obviously it's some sort of computer thing, because one of the things they keep saying is, we keep you in a box.
Right.
And they do. Because even though he doesn't have to live out in the hallway like a couple of other people do, obviously, clearly his existence is in the smallest apartment possible.
Right.
That's a little box. Literally, it's shown as being a little box.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like they're presenting Kay as, it's not that he's okay with being a slave per se. It's just, it's been explained to him that there is no better for him.
Right.
But he still wants better. He still, in his heart, believes he's not. And that's why when he finally concludes for himself, when he's talking to Stallone, the dream creator, and he says, well, what about this memory? Is this memory authentic? And she says, yes, somebody lived this. His response is rage, because he thinks it was him and that he's been lied to.
Right.
And he's very, very angry. It's rage, because I knew it.
And that's one of the things I like most about the film. Not only that,
it's narrative. You'd think it would be happy. I'm human, but it's not.
But also Gosling's performance, because later that proves to not be the case. I mean, the leader of the resistance explicitly says, you thought it was you.
Right.
And the reaction shot of Gosling, I think, is the best acting in the film.
Okay.
I mean, how do you play?
Yeah.
I've lived my entire life like this. There's that sad thing at the beginning where he explains, well, humans have souls.
Well, he doesn't explain that. She, Madam, the police boss, says rather offhandedly, you know, when he's talking about souls, and she says, well, lucky you don't have one. And you can see how stung he is. And she doesn't even think that that might hurt him.
Right.
So that's his reality. And then he's given this possibility that what he's always wanted is true and then had it snatched away from him.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very interesting character arc. And again, Gosling's performance is really, really good.
Yeah. No, I think almost everyone in the movie is really good. I'm not as crazy about Jared Leto. And
it's the worst thing about the movie for me.
I love the Celine, is that her name?
Yeah.
You guys have seen it twice. Her reaction when he describes the dream amazing, and even more so than in retrospect once we get to where the movie is going. I really like that scene. And again, I love all the little touches that they don't go overboard explaining, where they show her designing the different dreams.
With
or
the lenses.
Right.
The,
or the baseline really test or whatever. You know, it's like we see it, we can figure out what's going on, but the movie doesn't go out of its way to be like, okay, here's what this is, and we're going to explain
this. Which is rare in a contemporary film.
But
absolutely.
Which is something that they had to at least attempt. That's a style they had to at least attempt as a follow-up to the original Blade Runner.
Well, they didn't have to.
Well, you're right. They didn't have
to. But
the
right people were part of this.
Yes.
You know, again, the thing that gave me hope going into it was the fact that it is Denis Villeneuve, and he's a really good director and has made nothing but movies.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, that was incredibly good.
Including some great sci-fi.
Yes.
And Gosling's always interesting. One other thing I wanted to point out, and it's the reason I've had this phone out the whole time, because I'm bad with names, that I really liked as I was thinking about the performances last night. Ana de Armas, who plays Joy, is from Cuba, and English is not her native language.
Wow. Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
And then we have Sylvia Hooks. Who plays Love, and she's from the Netherlands, and English is not her first language. And then we have the leader of the resistance, who's the same story. Her name is Hayan Abbas. And I thought, like Rutger Hauer, and I don't know if this was intentional, but I think it's in the film, all three of these replicants speak English in a way that
their own particular
that the other characters don't. And what led me to this conclusion was something that we don't know whether to give the film credit for this or that it's a big mistake. When the fake replicant Rachel is introduced, Harrison Ford's problem is that her eyes are the wrong color. But when Rachel speaks, it's clearly not Sean Young. Because in the original Blade Runner, Sean Young came up with a way of speaking that was unique.
Okay.
And different. And different than the other characters. So when the Sean Young Mank speaks, it's wrong.
Yeah, it sounds wrong.
It's like, is this another mistake Wallace made in replicating her? Or is it just the filmmakers not wanting to go there? But I thought in a very subtle way, all of those female replicants, it worked because they don't have regular North American speech patterns. They really don't.
I hadn't really, maybe.
What did you guys think about the whole Joy character?
For one, the names Joy and Love are way too on the nose for me.
What are you talking about?
I'm sorry.
He's blind. Get it?
There are a couple. Actually, the movie's whole log line is a little too visible for me. It's like, okay, so in the original, we have a Blade Runner, and he's looking for a replicant, but he thinks he might be a replicant too. And in this one, it's like, so what if in the second we have a Blade Runner, but he's a replicant looking for a human who thinks he might be human? that was a little too on the nose for me. But as far as her character,
I think
she did an interesting job. I actually thought she did a good job.
Remember what Jan said earlier about that Tyrell in the original film was more human than human, and then Wallace decides, well, really, they don't have to be that human. think about what the corporation is selling Kay. Enjoy. Think about what that product is. And I think one of the things the film does well is we start to believe that they have a relationship,
right,
or at least have a relationship in Kay's eyes, so that at the end, when he's all beaten up and that enormous pink joy gives him the sales pitch. We were talking about this last night. It's chilling.
Yeah.
She even says you look like a good Joe.
The billboard, one of the first things the billboard says is one of the first things we hear Joy say when he comes to the apartment.
Right.
What is it something about his day?
What a day.
What a day.
You've had such a day. I think it's very similar, the second.
And if you think about it, and I think the screenwriters have, that's something that a certain type of person would really like. What a day. It's so generic, and yet it's empathetic and inviting. And
well, right. The movie convinces us that Joy has somehow transcended her programming in the way that we think Kay is essentially transcending his programming, because he believes to be human. He believes that he is something more than what he is, and that Joy essentially does the same thing. And so it's sad when she is killed, but really was her whole thing about transcending her programming, because her only programming is be whatever Kay wants you to be. And what he wants you to be is someone who's more than just a computer program, and to transcend your programming. So essentially, all of that stuff about her becoming more quote-unquote human is just part of the program to be what he wants.
Exactly.
Right, and that's why she keeps saying that you're more than you think you are.
Well, right.
Because her marketing is explicitly everything you want to see, everything you want to hear. So she's designed to tell him what he wants to hear.
I think that reflects in the audience as well, because yes, when it's like, let's escape together, we're going to be together, we're these two programs, we're these two robots or whatever creations who have formed a connection with each other. And so, yes, I invest myself emotionally in their relationship. And then when we get the giant pink Joy, it's like, oh, it was all a lie.
Yeah.
All of it was a lie.
And everything you want to see is so creepy.
Well, the context of how we started this podcast, But
everything you want to hear, okay, I get that. I'm fine with that. But everything you want to see is a can of worms.
They literally let the client choose the color of the eyes, the color of the skin, the color of the hair, the accent. So, I mean,
so this is something that I want to talk about. Maybe it's part of a larger conversation. But there's somebody that I follow on Twitter, a writer by the name of Lauren Brooks, and she has a blog called Suddenly a Shot Rang Out. And she wrote a piece that I suggest everyone read. She was not a fan of Blade Runner 2049 and wrote a piece called Flesh and Blood, The Misogyny of Blade Runner 2049, and essentially talks about
I had read criticisms of the film based on just that accusation.
Deeply misogynistic movie this is when you consider who all of the women are and what functions they serve in the story, and the way that the men interact with them, and the way they are insanely disposable.
And yet still somehow jealous of each other.
One of love's last lines is, I'm the best one.
Right.
There's also a rivalry between Joy is jealous. She says, oh, you don't like your madame better? And then when, after the prostitute sleeps with him, she says, I'm done with you now. You can go.
Right.
So, yeah.
But the criticism...
You can't talk true misogyny unless you include women hating each other.
The criticism I had read is that Harrison Ford, rumpled and older, and and Edward James Olmos, quite a bit older, are allowed to come back, but not Sean Young.
We're going to digitally preserve Sean Young, which again is almost the movie commenting on itself, or like fulfilling its own prophecy, where it's like, we want this thing to be perfect, and so we're going to make it in a computer. In terms of commenting on its own misogyny.
Sean Young, you come back as a bunch of bones.
Right.
See those bones?
With a scar from where you had a baby, because that's all
women are good for,
right? So I'm torn because I think a lot of the points this article makes are valid. I think there are so many things you could point to in the film as being misogynistic in the way that we are talking about. And I think in 2017, we have to do better because what I'm about to say flies in the face of this. I also think it's okay to tell a story through a male perspective. The problem is, it's just we've had so many of those that if I'm just looking at Blade Runner, this is a story that is about these men and the perspective through which they see the world, and they even want their computer programs to be jealous because that's something that men want to feel desired. Right. And so part of her programming is to be jealous, and how that reflects on the men as in a bad way. The problem is that so many movies are told through the male perspective. Yes. And so this, one that you want to be better, just kind of piles on.
I think that's a really interesting point. I think the first movie also gets blasted for misogyny.
Sure.
On a number of different levels, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't. I did think last night at some point, we have these, the ballet dancers are very lovely and beautiful, and we have the prostitutes who are available now as apparently a public service.
Right.
That they're just available.
Right.
And we have the Joy stand up, who's naked, and, it would have been so easy to include a naked guy mm-hmm. that women could buy.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been so easy to throw that in there.
Mm-hmm.
Did nobody think about it?
Sure.
I mean, because if we're talking about, hopefully 10 years from now, people will have looked back at this time and said, I can't get away with that shit anymore. And we learned from an earlier age that that's not right. Then did somehow good people really thinking about what they were doing
mm-hmm.
made this movie and didn't think
right.
of putting a naked guy in it?
Right. I think sometimes, and I don't want to put, my brain in other people's heads, but I think sometimes the thinking is, well, if we make some of the major characters female, that's progress.
Yes,
right.
But it's not.
It's not if this is their function.
Right.
If as this article points out, the movie seems to take a specific kind of joy, no pun intended, in love's drowning. How much time is spent watching her drown and how sort of insidious that feels, or how disposable Sean Young is because she's not exactly what a man wanted. So shoot her in the head, fuck her.
Right.
I think, by making love a woman or by making Madam a woman, see, he works for a woman. It's progress, but it's not.
Is it, though?
Exactly.
And sometimes you can't, your movie can't pass the Turing test just by having women in it.
Right.
Just by having women talking. They have to actually talk about something besides a man.
Right.
So sometimes it does bother me.
The Bechdel test? What's the Turing
Bechdel
test?
Oh, Turing test is something different. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Bechdel test.
Okay.
They have to talk about something besides a man. And sometimes it bothers me when I see a movie where I'm like, we've got strong women. Yeah, you made this strong woman character only to serve as the killer of another woman you want to be killed.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That you don't want to have a man kill.
100%.
So you added a strong woman character to kill her.
Right.
That's not better.
Right. Right.
So, Joy is the one, or Love, rather, is the one that kills Madam. Joy is the one that dismisses the prostitute. She hires the prostitute and then dismisses her.
Right.
So I think there is a little of that, and it is a little disappointing.
And I agree. And I'm not trying to play devil's advocate here, but
hoo-ah.
We do have the leader of the resistance, who's a female, and is not presented as an awful killer. The dream spinner.
That's like two scenes.
The creator of the memories
seems
to be the most sympathetic female character in the film.
And has also spent her life locked in a prison.
Well, doing
something that a man wants.
Men.
Right.
But here's my question. Does she honestly have the condition where she has to be the boy in the bubble syndrome because of immunity issues? Or is that part of the effort to hide her away?
I assumed that it was part of the effort to hide her.
Okay. So she could leave the bubble.
I think so.
But if she doesn't know that.
Well, at the end of the film, it's hinted she's going to find out.
Right.
Yes, but to that point, it wouldn't help her.
Because in the original, I don't know if you guys know this, in the original ending of Blade Runner 2049,
yeah.
It doesn't end with Harrison Ford's hopeful face. He tells her, and they run away together in a spinner, and we discover that
you're
there's
not
this
a replica.
Beautiful, there's this beautiful,
you're not.
There's this beautiful outdoor place that looks a lot like outtakes from The Shining,
yeah.
And that's how it ends.
But it's outtakes from the made-for-TV Shining, because yeah. That's the one that Stephen King prefers. Even the decision,
dream spinner was not a replica.
And this is something
a special model
that I think I'm borrowing from the Slash film cast. I don't want to plagiarize other people's ideas. I think that's where I heard this idea, and I thought, yes, that's actually correct. That by the end of the film, what we're supposed to realize is Ryan Gosling realizes this isn't his story. He thought he was special. He thought he was the one. And then he realizes he's not. And all of a sudden, this guy who we've been following realizes, oh, this isn't my story. But it's also not Deckard's story. It's actually Stallone. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually sort of Stallone's story. And so the decision to end the film on Harrison Ford's face instead of Stallone's face, I think once again speaks to this thing that we're talking about where it's like you're making something about a man when it shouldn't be. That's the wrong last shot for the movie.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
And it doesn't have the impact that it should have. If it was Stallone, I think there would be such a greater emotional impact on that last image.
And that's a great point.
By just reversing those shots.
Because she's really been the one he's been looking for all along.
She's the answer to all of it.
In fact,
she's who all of this is for.
She made the memory that's been driving all of the action.
Right.
She is the baby.
She's what the Resistance is working towards. She's what Kay has been working towards. She's what Bautista gives his life for. I mean,
she's the miracle.
Right. And if that's the case, and it clearly is, then one can argue that the way this movie is told, constructed, is kind of demented.
What do you mean?
If it's really her story,
right?
Why is she in so little of it? Because really, if you look at classic Hollywood structure, you could argue she's the MacGuffin. She's what everyone is chasing.
Well, she is that also.
But in the Hitchcock universe, the MacGuffin doesn't matter. It just exists to set the plot in motion.
I think because of the film being structured as a mystery, I think because of the misdirect with Kay, I'm okay with the realization that this has been her story all along happening at the very end of the film. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with not her being in more of the film. I just think the movie needs to accept that fact in the way that it chooses to end.
No, I agree 100% that you reverse the last two shots and it's a better film.
I just don't know if how much of this the movie is aware of, because there are certain movies that we've talked about before where we're like, yes, it seems deeply misogynistic. That's on purpose because it's getting us to talk about these things. And
no,
you know,
I don't think this movie's trying to get us to talk about that.
Right? I mean, it's having that effect, but unfortunately it seems to be unaware of how sort of male-dominated the perspective is, right?
I agree. I think from the filmmaker's perspective, it's balanced a bit. And I have not read the article, but I'm really interested in reading it. It is balanced a bit by the fact that Kay is also put in a box. Kay is also designed for a function. Mm-hmm. And it's made very clear that people only see him in terms of that function. Even to some extent, Joy.
But I feel like he's given free will in a way that some of the women aren't. And the scene that I would point to is, and it's a little kind of a subtle thing, but I thought it was really interesting when Robin Wright is drinking
I was going to bring that up.
Throws out a line where she's basically like, hey, what would it be like to fuck a replicant?
What if I finish this bottle?
Right.
Yeah.
And he turns her down. And see, that free will is something that
the female characters
don't have. So when we're talking about...
I don't think it's definite that he turns her down.
He doesn't turn her down. He just doesn't follow it through. He doesn't say, no, I'm not going to sleep with you.
Okay.
In my...
No, you're right. You're right. No, he kind of just lets it lay there and doesn't...
But that is one of the... I was going to bring this up. That is one of the most interesting lines of dialogue in the film.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that bothered us last night is Robin Wright gives a fine performance and she's just saddled with the worst dialogue. Mm-hmm. Every one of her lines seems designed for the trailer.
In the trailer, that made me want to kill myself. Yeah, this breaks the world.
And that's not the only one.
No, I know.
She's got three or four whoppers.
And they don't, like, she says these hugely dramatic things, and they don't really show how that would happen.
Well, but I...
lives on a wall.
This is a wall, and if you tear down the wall, you got a war.
They do show us an actual wall, but I don't think that's
what
they
mean. That stuff is stupid, but I remember seeing the trailer where she says, this breaks the world, and I was like, oh, what is this going to be? What could possibly break the world? And I thought the answer was interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's so self-serving. You know, she's essentially the only human character in the movie, right? And it's so self-serving because it's like, hey, if people find this out, we can't have slaves anymore.
Yeah.
And and that's going to end our way of life. And yet she's, you know, one of the heroes of the film. She's on the good side, theoretically.
Speaking of the wall, tangent. I was looking at that wall very closely last night because we saw it twice. And... that big wall seems to be something that's been built.
To hold the ocean back.
Right. Yeah. And that's something I really, really like.
Yeah.
A little tip of the hat. Oh, no. This.
We already broke the world.
Right.
The only problem I have with that is that clearly the reason Wallace wants the baby is so he can somehow figure in. This is why he wants Deckard. This is why he wants the baby. He wants to figure out how to make replicants have babies.
Right.
If that breaks the world, like, why would he do it? Like, because then the world's broken in a way from which he profits?
No, yes, well, because his idea is replicants need to run the show. And Robin Wright, as the human, is saying,
no,
we are the majority, right? Yeah. I mean, they're not, but we're in power. Right. And if suddenly they figure out how to replicate themselves, we are fucked.
Yeah.
Robin, Madam understands that.
Right.
Wallace thinks that if he figures it out, he can do nothing but profit from it. I believe he is wrong.
Well, there will just be more angels.
I can't make
there'll
them
be even
fast
more
enough.
Angels.
I can't make them fast enough.
Right.
Well,
but impregnating them isn't the fastest, most expedient way to do
that. 9 months, lots of resources.
Assuming that the gestation period is the same, which I guess we don't
know.
You need
a lot more of those worms for people to eat.
You have to grow them from childhood. So, yeah.
And as Jan has pointed out, two little flaws in the film. If the problem
one,
is Wallace...
Who cast Jared Leto?
Okay, that's one. Number two, if he can't make replicants fast enough, and clearly replicants are treated like second-class citizens... What about this crazy orphanage place where there's seemingly thousands of children?
Yeah, right.
Can be humans are being enslaved.
The orphan factory.
The most vulnerable humans are the ones who are still slaves.
Speaking of orphan planet, something that occurred to Jan and I, when Kay gets close to orphan planet, that whole sequence is a lot like Garbage Planet in Thor. It's
really
with the inhabitants,
right.
In both cases, the hero is saved by a strong woman.
Right.
It's like, what, did someone sneak into the Marvel office and or vice versa and see the previs and say, Garbage Planet is a good thing to have? And two.
You want a Garbage Planet, too.
Wait, casting Jared Leto was one. Three, a quibble. Leto tries to appeal to Harrison Ford because he says, pain means nothing to you. You love pain. Mm-hmm. It reminds you you're alive, or whatever that overwritten line is. And then, within minutes, I'm taking you off world. where you're going to experience pain like you never have. And at that point, Harrison Ford should say, thanks.
Yeah, right.
Because I've had, you're right, I love
at
this pain.
Point,
yes, Wallace,
new
I
pain?
Have another.
New pain?
New pain.
Because I'm not a robot.
New pain.
I can feel pain.
At that point, I thought he was going to bring an Imperial torture droid into the chamber.
What do you guys think about
they
the
didn't
scene
even ask
where,
me
they,
any questions.
Where they bring Sean Young back?
I actually thought the whole thing was kind of oddly conceived.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because, again, I think it's one of these moments that's almost too self-reflexive to work, where it's like, let's remind Deckard of 1982 Blade Runner. And in the process, reminding audience of 1982 Blade Runner.
But we can't hire Sean Young.
Right.
She's
And what makes it really
she said
meta.
That thing about James Woods. Oh, wait. James Woods is a legitimate monster?
Worse.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe let's believe Sean Young.
What makes it really meta is the uncanny valley Rachel that they produced through CGI.
Still not there.
Isn't right.
Right.
So as a viewer and a lover of the original Blade Runner,
our
objection to CGI Rachel is the same as Harrison Ford's.
Right.
It's not right.
That's not Rachel.
That's not right.
I don't know. I thought it was...
Okay, you know what it reminded me of a little? And you might be a little young to remember how music videos...
I'm pretty old.
Not as old as Harrison Ford. but you know how music
not
videos
a robot.
In the 90s for songs that are featured in movies?
Mm-hmm.
So then they do a video for the song,
and
the movie would be in the video
somehow? Yeah, I love it.
Like
love
there's
that.
A TV in the background that's playing clips of the movie.
Yeah.
I think you showed one on Scary Movie Night.
I probably showed a bunch.
That's what that scene in Blade Runner 2049 reminded me of. It was like
there's
their
a TV
way...
showing Blade Runner in the background. Yeah,
there literally was.
Right, right.
And I'm like, oh, they just this is the movie that came from that, so they have to show little clips of it.
Again, I mean, in a way, I admire their. Desire to really tie it together in a way that isn't just connecting every single little dot. They chose to go with this one thread, and the relationship that we didn't see between Deckard and Rachel begat this other thing, and that's the jumping off point for our story. That's all interesting.
Yes, I like that.
But the appearance of CGI Sean Young, I just thought was...
It was a little step in.
Yeah.
I think the best decision they made was to not try to copy the original, but just to speak the same language.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a lot of the same visual language. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of the same. The image set is really similar with eyes, with memory, with what's real and what's not real. In fact, I kind of see the whole relationship between Kay and Joy as a metaphor for the relationship between the two movies, you know, to your point of how the filmmakers are trying to tie the two together. One thing I really love about the original is how much of the sets are practical.
Yes.
And how well realized they are and how well lit they, I mean, what he does with light in that movie is just amazing. And so in this, like, we just know that those shots are CGI.
Right.
We just know.
But
even though they look great.
There is a lot of interesting lighting, though.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great
gorgeous.
Looking movie. But to your point, one of the things that's such a miracle about Blade Runner, which I had seen a bunch of times before I ever watched that Dangerous Days documentary.
I saw it a bunch of times this week.
Dangerous Days documentary, right? That's what it's called. The 4-hour thing.
Yeah.
Watching that the first time, I think, gave me an appreciation for Blade Runner that I hadn't had previously because it made me realize this thing exists where nothing existed before it. And that's the difference between Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. 2049 has Blade Runner.
Exactly.
To build on and to use that language and to create these ideas and this world and all that. Blade Runner just... I mean, you had the Philip K. Dick story, but, like, it just wasn't a thing, and then someone made all that come together.
Yeah.
And the last time Jan and I saw Blade Runner in a movie theater, I just sat there, and it was like a mantra. I kept saying, this is before CGI.
Right.
This is before CGI. Yeah.
Right.
At most of the really show-stopping shots that they're like, always the street outside the Bradbury where the car goes by. They're always showing that in various ways. But you're like, holy God.
But like Ridley Scott and his lighting director, whose name escapes me, I'm sorry, he's a genius. They figured out how to make that eye shine, that replicant
eye shine. Right.
Like no one would even stop to think about that.
Right.
It would
we'll all do it in post.
Be done in post.
Right.
So yeah. So when you look at these sort of this Russian nesting doll of realness, you know, where you have this idea of what's human, and then you have inside of that is, you know, one step removed this idea of what a replicant is,
mm-hmm.
and then one step removed from that is joy, you know, and what she is. I think that's really interesting, and I think there's sort of, for me, there was sort of this metaphor in that relationship between the quote-unquote realness
mm-hmm.
of the original Blade Runner and the createdness of the second movie. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
One thing I wondered last night was, would it be interesting if the same actress had played Joy and Love? That somehow, based on Wallace's Commerce,
Well, that's interesting because in the Philip K. Dick book, the character of Rachel is the same model as his wife, I believe.
And wasn't there a time when, in the original film, Pris and Zora...
Or maybe there's someone... I can't remember. It's been so long since
Pris
I read the
and
book.
Zora were the same model.
Yeah.
But then Zora got
maybe
training to be on the Kick Murder Squad, that they started out at both as basic pleasure models.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book, so I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I'm
but
a terrible, terrible person.
I liked the Love and the Joy performances. I really did.
Yeah.
The first time I saw it, it bothered me. The Love performance bothered me because I think I was snookered in, which the film wants you to be, by that character because of when she's crying.
Okay.
And then I thought her switch to a Bond villain was sort of abrupt. But the second time I watched it, I'm like, oh, no, 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 that you were completely wrong. She's a Bond villain from the minute she appears.
Okay.
Well, there's that great scene where she's directing the drone to kill the garbage invaders.
Yeah.
Right.
And she's just very nonchalantly, fire again. Fire everything. You know, and it's just so,
But even when she shows up at the archive, and the minute she shows up, the little functionary...
It's an interesting movie because I think it has some pretty significant flaws, but I think it means well in so many ways.
And we have to remind ourselves, which is what I thought the first time I saw it, if you look at what is passing itself off as entertainment lately,
right.
You must go see Blade Runner 2049. Yes.
It's ambitious and beautiful, and it's science fiction for adults, and it's trying to say something. I appreciate. I don't think the screenplay is like perfect, but I appreciate that watching it. You know, as I went to see it, we get that sort of cold open with Dave Bautista.
Yeah,
and I assume that that's what it is. It's a cold open where we get to see Kay retire a replicant, so we can see. Oh, okay, he's a Blade Runner also. But that scene really is the genesis of the entire movie because of what he finds on the farm, because of what Bautista says to him. And so I think it's smart in the way that it threads things through in a way that is thought out and consistent. And
a bad sequel would have just had Kay go through a thinly disguised version of what Deckard goes through in the original film. That's
correct.
What they would have done.
Correct.
It would not have been a sequel. It would have been a remake.
Right.
Winkety, winkety, wink.
Right.
That was my... When I first heard the inklings that this thing was... That they were going to be making it, my biggest fear was that it was going to be some sort of attempt at a remake or a reboot.
Right, right.
Which just made me want to...
Which it is
away.
And it isn't, you know? Again,
well,
it's different enough from the original, I think, to stand on its own.
In very purposeful ways.
Yes. Yeah. Even if there are obviously major echoes. I'm a little bit irritated that this is now the third Harrison Ford sort of legacy sequel that's just about who his kids are. because we had Mutt in Indiana Jones. We have
Kylo Ren
in The Force Awakens, and now we have Stallone in this one. So it's really just about Harrison Ford as a bad dad.
Well, right? you go into
he's
a
terrible dad.
It's the bad dad.
You
trilogy.
Go into a studio head's office. It's a bonanza. What other film could we mine for this Force 10 from Navarone? Let's bring that guy back. He's still on the mountain.
Regarding Henry's kids.
A witness. Oh, I like it.
Regarding Henry's kids.
A witness sequel where the child is half cop and half Amish. Yeah. And both sides want the kid. It's essentially
right.
just Blade Runner 2049.
Witness
but with
my
Amish.
Disappointing son.
But Amish instead of replicants.
Yeah.
I think we're on to something. Hollywood, take note.
I'm so relieved that this sequel did hit so many of the marks in a way that was not disrespectful of the original.
Yeah.
It
that
is
it
not
makes
a cheap cash-in.
No, it
right,
is not a cheap
right.
cash-in, but it does make me dismayed that they're pretty clearly setting up Blade Runner 3, the Blade Runnering.
I didn't feel that.
Did you see that last night, that they're setting up the sequel? I really fear that.
No, but now that you mention it,
what would the sequel be?
It would be terrible.
There's the
no
resistance.
Way it could not be terrible. Yes.
Yeah. That's
yes.
That's the.
I'm sorry. I really
that's,
feel
that's
it coming.
The third Matrix movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's not. Nobody
don't
needs
do
that.
It.
Yeah.
Nobody needs that.
Plus, am I the only one who thinks that Kay may be dead at the end?
No,
I don't think it's a
clearly
may.
Clearly dead.
Yeah. No, he's dead.
That's
oh.
the point.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You should have just seen the look I shot
him.
No.
I'm speaking of if you wanted to do a sequel
right.
and bring Kay back.
Right. No, you can't.
I got that
no,
he was
he
dead.
He would
okay.
be the joy-like replicant.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like Deckard's little
yeah,
hologram
right.
sidekick.
Yeah.
Gosh, Deckard, I don't think we should go in there.
This is my sidekick. He's a robot.
Look, at the beginning, they
Let's
don't
go
want
back
to work
to Vegas.
Together at all.
Right?
But by the end, they've reached a grudging respect.
Because as it turns out,
these
Harrison
two are going to solve this case if they don't kill each other first.
Wow, I feel good. Harrison Ford is a week away from retiring. Getting too old for this shit.
Kind of a loose cannon.
Why the bees?
I
stopped
films.
The podcast dead.
That was the films, I think. To environmental
okay.
yeah.
matters.
Okay.
I mean, is the dog real? Maybe Harrison Ford
well,
in that abandoned
Deckard says
casino
ask him.
Has got the key to maybe bringing some things back.
I think it's a symbol, you know.
Okay.
It's a symbol of life. He literally, when he sees it on the heat, on the heat picture, he says, life.
Mm-mm. You guys did just see it last night.
Yeah, we
so.
Did just see it last night. there are you don't really notice them, but in his Vegas penthouse, there are jars of honey.
Yeah, I noticed that for a second.
So he's just
likes
just a fan of honey.
He just likes honey.
Got it.
Call me sweet, sweet honey man.
That should have been a third female character. We'd have joy, love, and honey.
Honey's a beekeeper and is really presented in the spirit that
but also
love.
A prostitute.
Well,
yeah. They all have to be prostitutes.
That love is a Bond villain. Honey would be the Bond girl.
Oh, yes.
Da-da-da-da. We're replicants.
Honey
da-da.
Vagina. They're not even trying.
Just. They gave up. Films and films ago.
Yeah.
Will this make either of your top tens?
Oh, my gosh.
I don't think it's been a particularly good year for movies.
I don't either, but there's a lot I haven't seen.
So it might.
Okay.
I liked it a lot more last night than I did the first time.
I want like to see it again then.
I don't know if I could. Yeah, it feels too disloyal.
Disrespectful to the original.
It does. It just
I get
feels
it.
Disrespect. Not,
I get
not,
it.
Even not disrespectful.
That's why I'm not putting
disloyal.
Daddy's Home 2. Forget it. I fucked up the Daddy's Home 2 on
Jan's,
my list.
On
there
Jan's top 10 list for 2017, she's just going to obstinately put the original Blade Runner.
Put Blade Runner.
What?
It's always number one.
Sean Young, Harrison Ford, they're in the movie.
Yeah, the real Sean Young. It was great.
That sounds like it's going to be a reality show on TV. The real Sean Young.
She... Oh, no. Never mind. I thought she had a reality show, but she doesn't. She's doing, like, tours in Austin, I think, right?
Yeah, she's doing something.
Yeah.
What is the tour?
Austin? No, I don't know.
Is it, like...
I think it's film-related.
She was doing theater for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. She still pops up and stuff. I feel like I just saw her in something not that long ago. But I couldn't tell you what it was, so never mind.
It was a pleasure to see Edward James Olmos.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice, right? They brought him back.
I thought his scene was well written, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was all right.
Anything else about Blade Runner 2049?
I recommend that folks see it.
Yes.
And I recommend that Hollywood stop thinking that everything has to be a sequel.
Yeah.
But that keeps making movies that are ambitious and gorgeous.
Yes. And hire Denis Villeneuve to make them.
Yeah,
just don't make him sequels.
Absolutely.
He doesn't need to make Dune.
No.
His talents are better served. He's going to make a great science fiction movie, I have no doubt. But his talents are better served doing something else.
Yeah, agreed.
Which I love.
So. Yeah. Anyway, find more of us at fthismovie.com and follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store. Rate and review us if you haven't. Listen to us on Stitcher, blah, blah, blah.
And I am not a robot. And where did Patrick go?
I know it's real.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.